Hi, this is Ted Price from Insomniac Games. On today's episode of the Game Maker's Notebook, I got to know Mikhail Kasurinen from Remedy. Mikhail is the game director at Remedy, and he directed their latest big hit, Control, as well as Quantum Break. Mikhail describes Remedy's approach to handling the current pandemic. He talks about his game design philosophy and how Remedy has evolved from a single project studio to a multi-production developer. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook.
Oh, great. Yeah, thank you.
And what's really interesting about our talk today is that we are at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, and we are both talking to each other from different countries. Mikhail is in Finland. I'm in Los Angeles, California. And I'm really interested in how Remedy has been affected by what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, of course, it's been a huge change, and it has had a very kind of a pragmatic impact to how we work. I mean, you used to come to the office, of course, at meetings, and there's a lot of this kind of low-level communication that happens when you're around people and talk about stuff. So what this change has done, besides the technical stuff, of course, that everybody has to work from home, but it has also affected our communication. And it kind of changes the way we have to be more proactive in how we talk. We need to set up calls and so on. So there is this kind of organic element of communication that is gone, and now we need to kind of have this extra effort to make it happen again. And we recognize that, and we work a lot on that, and so on. And while this change has been big, what's been to me pretty amazing is how quickly we have adapted at the end of the day. I'm actually at the office right now. I came here just to record this, and pretty much everybody's working from home. I think almost like 90%, and we're kind of moving forward. And it's kind of crazy how quickly we are doing this as if it's almost normal. That's strange.
Do you think anything will change permanently for Remedy as a result of going through this?
For sure. I think there will be people who actually enjoy that this is actually a better way to do certain type of things from home, where you can have some peace and quiet. Certain type of jobs really need that. Writers, I'm sure many coders and so on. And now that we have actually set up the kind of a remote desktops and all of that technology and so on, I think there's going to be a lower barrier in the future to just stay at home and work from there, which I think is a good thing.
Are there government restrictions currently that prevent people from coming to work, or is this a voluntary thing for everybody in Finland?
It's a voluntary thing.
Oh, okay. How do you think Finland is going to be affected long term by this?
That's a good question. It's really, really hard to tell. I think there will be a cultural impact, but because the health situation has been fairly well contained, I think. I don't think there's been like a bad situation over here. So we've been lucky, I think, and there's been. The government has definitely reacted very quickly and so on. So it's hard to tell. I think it really depends not necessarily about the amplitude of the situation, but really that how long lasting this is. And we'll see. I really don't know.
Do you think that our games industry is going to evolve maybe positively or negatively as a result of this?
I think, not that I think about it, I think there exists a lot of indie studios already out there that basically everybody works remotely, that they don't even have an office. And it's been a natural thing for me for the last 20 years to go to the office and work from there. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's a kind of a new generation of game makers out there that this will become a norm. Like this is how they're used to working maybe already, and maybe it will be a more common thing from now on that many studios widely will work remotely and from home. And I wouldn't be surprised by that at all.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. Since you've worked for 25 years doing things in a certain way, I have too. You know, I find that people who have been in the industry for a while take for granted that face-to-face communication is essential, physical face-to-face communication. Mm-hmm. But I know that what we found is that, ironically, Zooming or using Teams or any kind of video conferencing creates a face-to-face communication in a very different way, but one that we can't experience in physical meetings, because you're actually literally seeing every single person's face at the same time. So you pick up even, we find at least, you pick up even more emotional cues and have a different type of connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's even in kind of one-on-one calls, there is this interesting intensity, is probably the wrong word, but there is this different way that you pay attention when you kind of talk to a person on your monitor. I don't know what changes, but there's something different there that I'm having a hard time putting my finger on it. And it took a while for me to kind of realize that it was different. And somehow I think there is like the atmosphere that you have in the office, it's a bit more kind of a noisy and complicated. A lot of things happening, people walk into the room, a lot of things are going on as you talk with somebody else. But when you have this conference call, you're just in your study, you have the monitor, it's just kind of you and him, and there's a certain kind of focus, I think, in the discussion. And it's been interesting. I've been having like all day calls, and you kind of feel almost a bit drained after doing it for a while, because there is that, this is additional energy to the situation that is going on. But I've noticed that it actually in a way makes it more efficient. There is certain kind of I don't know what it is. It's just, it's interesting. There's like, it's more cohesive somehow compared to us sitting at the office on kind of easy chairs and so on. So there's something different about it that I think is, it's interesting.
I think you're right. I'm glad you brought up the point about feeling drained after a day of video calls. I feel the same way. And I know that other insomniacs I've talked to have felt that too. And it's, I think you're exactly right. It's that intensity. You're sort of on stage, right? When you're talking to somebody else who's on a screen in front of you versus sitting in a room full of people. That's interesting. Well, I guess I'm also looking forward to seeing how the industry changes potentially policies or approaches, or how big game companies evolve to support this down the road, more work from home.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, when we look at these really big studios where already a game is built by a number of different studios, and I'm having sometimes hard time seeing how it's even possible that these things come together, because it can get so complex, so massive, these different workloads. So in a kind of a macro level, there is already this kind of in a strange way, like the separation of work that happens into a big project, into multiple different studios. And it's kind of happening now in a micro level, where people kind of detach from each other and go home and work from there. So there's this kind of layers and layers of that going on.
What do you think it changes for somebody like you who is running large teams?
It's tough for me, because what I'm used to doing is when we're at the office, a huge part of my day is to talk, connect with people. And I care a lot about how people are thinking, what they're working on, and kind of want to understand. And a huge part of that is that sometimes you use a whiteboard, sometimes you sit down at the workstation and look at something, or use some kind of a physical element that allows us to communicate, right? And in the absence of that, I noticed that there is this additional, this kind of barrier that kind of has appeared in this situation. And it's less organic. It's harder for you to improvise in a situation and say, how about this? And should we do that? And that's what I mean as well. Like the kind of the conference calls, the video kind of conferencing limits in a way that, and you need to maybe just think differently and make kind of different choices on how you choose to communicate. And so that's been a huge change for how I need to work. And I think I'm still in the middle of rediscovering what's that kind of a new way of handling that.
So in a way, this is sort of like additional leadership training for all of us who have to manage teams, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, and I'll just, this is the last thing I'll talk about on the subject, but I don't know if you've seen this, but in calls where there are a whole lot of people who are participating in a video conference, I find that speech patterns are different. And there's a different style of communicating that just doesn't exist in person. And it's subtle, but it's like we're all learning a new rule set about how to talk. Have you experienced that?
Yeah. Now that you say that, I'm kind of realizing that that's exactly what I think has been happening as well, that there's, you somehow project yourself differently. It's almost like you're giving speeches instead of talking, if you know what I mean. It's a bit hard to express, but yeah, there is that different way and different style, definitely.
I think maybe the irony is that for those of us who are so used to being in the physical environment, it is sort of new. But then for a couple generations who are younger than we are, it's a little bit more natural because that's how a lot of communication has been done, right? Mm-hmm. I look at my kids and they're constantly on video chat anyway, or they were. So right. Anyways, yeah. It's interesting times.
Absolutely.
But I think what I want to talk more about is remedy and especially control. And first of all, congratulations on such a great game with Control. And the fact that it won 4 DICE awards, including Action Game of the Year, is awesome. So way to go.
Thank you so much. It means a lot to us, more than you can imagine, really.
Well, it was great seeing you guys up on stage and hearing how you, of course, share credit with the entire team. And I felt like playing Control was a really fresh experience because of so many different things that you did in the game. And one of those I want to talk about in particular because you're the game director, and that's the decision not to really hold players' hands. And I found that immediately apparent going into the game that I just was sort of on my own and I was faced with some fairly in-depth options for upgrades, et cetera, that weren't explained. And I found that a really refreshing experience. But did you guys argue over that approach early on?
Yeah, it was. There's a kind of a bigger foundation to that thinking. And it comes from a relatively simple place. I think in modern times, a lot of games, and I think it's a good practice that we want to help people to understand what the game is, right? And we want them to learn it quickly because when they've learned it, that's when it becomes fun. But the process of learning can be tedious. It can be frustrating. And I think there's like this barrier that sometimes exists for people, players, that they don't want to even learn a new game because it takes that extra effort. And part of the thinking there is that, and I might be wrong on this, which I would be really ready to admit, but I think when the game is not trying to teach you, right, when it's kind of just showing you interesting elements, and through that there is this invitation that is given to the player, right? And with that invitation, there's this unspoken contract that is created. If I, as a player, choose to accept that invitation, then I also choose to put in my own effort to participate. And when I choose to do it, like I make the choice of, I want to know more, I want to learn this game, and the game is not just putting these things in front of you, I think it's a more engaging experience. I think it's more, it feels more valuable. It feels like something that you are driving instead of being driven, like that somebody else is kind of telling you what to do. And through that, I think the experience becomes compelling. And then part of the experience of learning the game is also about learning about the world, learning about what's going on, what are the rules, and then those rules themselves are part of the experience. It's simple, but at the same time, kind of complicated. And there's a huge risk, of course, involved with that. And how do you find the right balance? Because you want people to have enough, kind of be able to see enough elements in there that so that the invitation works, that it's like it's enough, so that you just don't feel like, oh, I'm not even interested in the first place. But anyway, that's the kind of thinking there. And through that, we kind of sneakily introduce certain kind of elements, and then as you go through the world, as you do things, you kind of learn them, but it has to come from the player's own volition.
Well, you mentioned there's a huge risk in doing this. So how did you mitigate that risk?
Testing. And I think there is there's a point where you need to be able to take that leap of faith. I knew with what we were doing that it's going to be divisive. I had no doubt about that. I knew that that's going to happen. But what was important to me was that we do something that has the courage to stand apart. And again, I believed and do believe that through that kind of presentation, people will get it. They will see it, but they need to be ready to kind of accept that challenge and be ready to participate. So there wasn't really any big, clear mitigation plan. I think it was micro decisions here and there. Initially, we didn't actually have a map either. Hmm. My initial idea for the map was that you have to actually find in-game maps, like, you know, posters on the wall, for instance. And once you find them, you will see roughly where you are and what is the kind of nearby environment and navigate from there. But it turned out to be a relatively complex problem to solve, and we would have to create a lot of different assets, and sometimes it was hard to justify the idea of a map if you're in an alternate dimension and so on. So sometimes it kind of became a bit too complicated to pull off, and so we kind of ended up like, okay, let's kind of just do that. Let's have a map, but let's do it with the way where we don't, you know, spoil the experience through the map. The map is a tool for you to allow you to understand your relationship with the world and kind of leave it at that. Interestingly, we got a lot of feedback of the map that it wasn't communicating enough. And that's exactly, I was a bit worried about that, because I knew that the moment we put in a map, we can't, it's like giving you a little finger to the devil, that it will escalate into, like, that people hold on to that, and then that becomes the thing that they will use. And what's a shame about that, and the reason why I hesitated even with the map, was that to me, people too often, like when they kind of jump into the worlds that we create, they focus more on the tools that we give them than into the substance of the world, right? And a huge part of my goal with Control was to create a world, and the world is your guide in a way. Sorry, it sounds pretentious, but it really, to me, would be a way for people to pay attention to the world, and through that, I believe that they would have a more deep and rich experience, that they find things that they wouldn't otherwise. If there's a quest market that just tells you where to go and what to do at any given time, that becomes the game, instead of you just being in this world trying to find your way through that. So in a way, it is about immersion and less about this feeling of here's a task for you that you need to do, and it's more about, hey, you're in this world, and it's up to you to choose how you go through it, what you want to focus on, and so on. So it's about agency at the end of the day.
I think that came through really well in the game, and I am glad you included a map. I think I would have had trouble without it. At the same time, I felt like the map was a puzzle in itself, because there were things that I had to figure out about how the map worked that were not intuitive. I mean, not intuitive is not the right word. That challenged me in a good way, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt like it wasn't just like your philosophy. It was subservient to your philosophy of not leading players by the nose. And so I really liked how it felt like it fit in that philosophy, in that sort of unspoken philosophy. But we could talk about maps and this philosophy all day. I'm an action gaming guy too, and I really enjoy great mechanics. And what I loved, and I've seen a lot of people express this too, was your throwing mechanic. And it just felt really good. The pickup and throw, the psychokinesis ability.
Launch.
Launch. Yeah. And yes. I felt like that became my go-to throughout the game, just because it was really intuitive. So was that something that took you a long time to get right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It was interesting. So from the get-go, I think right after Quantum Break, even during it, I've been toying around with the idea of, I wanted to do a game about telekinetic powers, and the idea of using the environment as a weapon would be like a fundamental aspect of it. And I knew that it's been tried in different ways in different games, and I had a lot of people being very concerned about it, and not from Remedy necessarily, even like other colleagues and so on, that there's a lot of risk and how you're gonna, you know, make it work and so on. And my plan was, the thinking behind it was that we need to build the game in a very specific way from the get-go, that it has to be there day one, otherwise it won't work. The key point really was to not create unnecessary micro choices for the player that becomes a burden. Using launch should be more about the decision of using it and the end result of it, like the tactical decision that now I want to use it for that specific purpose. Sometimes that use could be sparked by that the object that you could pick up could be powerful, like a fire extinguisher and so on. But the point was that it needed to be trivial. It needed to be almost like you didn't even have to think about it to be able to do it. Yeah. And kind of focus on the interesting choice. I didn't want people to, let's say, scan around the environment and let me try to find an object that I can telekinetically pick up and then I will throw it. That would be terrible, because then we would add this extra layer in front of it and make it a tedious burden, like, oh, I need to look for markers in the environment, something like that. So in other words, what it meant was that we had to make every single object something that you can use, like right from the get-go. We have to accept that there's no other choice. If it looks like I can pick it up, then you can pick it up. That was the rule. And the other tricky thing was that, well, what if there is nothing, and so on? And for that, it wasn't either okay for me that, okay, then we, like, the easy decision would have been that, okay, then it kind of fails and you get the bump sound and, you know, sorry, no objects. That would be bad as well. It needs to be a thing that you can rely on, right? Otherwise, you won't use it. You'll just, you know, find this kind of replacement activities or ways to play it in a different way. And then we kind of lose that kind of thing that makes it cool and interesting. So what we did was that Jesse literally rips out the piece from the wall or from the floor and so on. So then we basically spawn that object, however we need to do it. So there was a massive effort, not necessarily from a game design perspective. I mean, the design is, at the end of the day, I'm not going to say it's simple, but it's relatively straightforward. But the pipelines, the workflows from environment art, physics, technical art, all of that stuff, there was like a huge underlying effort that had to happen there. We had to think about space in a different way. We had to think about propping in a different way. So it had a huge, this kind of a lower level impact to how we worked. And I'm going to be honest, it took a while for it to really be clear to everybody how vast that effort was. But to me, it was essential. And to me, it's a huge part of the game. The idea, even the name of the game, it's control. It is about controlling the environment. It's about controlling the minds of enemies. There's mind control. And there's this kind of thematic layer, of course, like who's in control, taking control back and so on. So it has this, you know, different levels to it and so on. So to me, it was at the heart of this action experience. It is ultimately about controlling things.
Well, I hope every designer or every person who wants to be a designer listens to what you just said about why you made those decisions. And I believe that as being surrounded by designers, it's often easy to just assume that, oh, we should make it hard. You know, players should have to work for those moments. But the fact that you do make it so intuitive and easy to use, but also strategically layered, is brilliant. And it's, I'm sure a lot of people have overlooked that, but I'm really glad you talked about it.
Absolutely.
I also want to say that the sound, I mean, Wow, that sound that you guys use for it really stood out to me, and it gave that particular mechanic a personality that is just unique.
Yeah, so there's this interesting, like whenever we talk about unleashing attacks, and there needs to be this sense of, as you know, there needs to be this build up, this kind of a tension that we set up, and then it's kind of a launch or like, you know, using a gun that it kind of is fired and so on, and that little sound that you get when the object flies to you, it is this kind of a promise that mm-hmm. you feel when it's coming to you. And then when you release the trigger, it's like, boom, like flies off. And it was interesting. I spent a lot of time talking actually about the details of that with the audio designers. And there's an interesting thing actually, even with launch, where initially the moment when you release the object, like it was actually literally launched, the sound was more explosive. It was like a boom, like, you know, it's almost like firing a gun. And I actually wanted to change that because it ate away from the consequence of that object hitting what it needed to hit. Mm-hmm. And because I wanted that sense of physicality of the action to be at the forefront. What did you just do? Is like, we need to communicate that through sound. So we amplified the kind of collision of that object hitting whatever it needed to hit and lessened the sound when it was launched. So you get this interesting, like a little sound when it's kind of hurtling forward. And then when it hit, you get this satisfying kind of oomphy collision sound. So yeah, a lot of
counterintuitive. I mean, that's the opposite of a gun, right?
So exactly, yes. But that kind of added, I think, a unique feel to it, that there's this kind of sense of satisfaction to it.
Yeah. Again, another great lesson for designers to take to heart. So I want to take a step back. I mean, you talk about, as a game director, the importance of making these decisions and working with team members. So what exactly does a game director do at Remedy?
that's a good question. So my answer is not going to be direct. I'm sorry about that. I think every single director defines how they want to work, what they want to focus on at the end of the day. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and And I think it's up to the director to find the right way to deal with them and then find the right way to work with them. Sometimes I think any director needs to be a mature person, and understanding themselves is crucial. And then you find the right people to support you, to assist you, and so on. And through that, you establish a creative communication pipeline, basically. You find the right people to work with, and you delegate the things that you need to delegate, and you kind of take it upon yourself, the things that you feel like are crucial in the experience, and deal with them more directly. So every director, I think, is unique in that sense. And I think it's the director's right as well to choose how they want to handle it. Of course, they have a lot to prove, and they need to be able to provide the kind of creative briefing to the team in a way that allows it to be something that they can take and use and run with, and they have the understanding of how to deal with the situation when things don't work out, as you know, often don't. So at Remedy, I think it's an interesting question also, because we have Sam Blake, for instance, who has an amazing amount of experience in the industry, and he's the creative director of the studio. And the way he works is of course different compared to how I work, and of course, you know, Sam focuses on the story side, but he's of course a very kind of he's filled with this sense of kind of creativity. He's like bubbling off that and so on. Whereas I'm more from kind of a game designer's perspective, and he's more from the writing perspective. Mm-hmm. So different kind of a starting points. But overall, I think the responsibility, if you kind of take a step back and kind of don't look at the person and the kind of bullet point list of what they're supposed to do, and look at their role within the studio, we have one game director per project, and that person's job is to basically be the evangelist of the vision of the game. And it is a complex role, because at Remedy, it doesn't mean that the game director focuses only one, or like, as you know, I mean, obviously, it's not about one or two or three different aspects of the game. It's everything. His job is to make sure that all of these different little things come together in a cohesive way, and that there's a plan, and there's this web of connection point and ideas that makes it all work together. It's a really complex burden to carry, and kind of going back to what I said before, that you need to have a lot of really talented, experienced creative leads there to support you, to work with you, to be able to carry the burden of certain things and be proactive. And to me, the best moments actually usually are when I talk about the thing that we want to achieve with the game, and give like write a creative brief, go through it, have a meeting. And usually what I always want to do is to give the lead a bit of time to process, to internalize and think about it, and to come back. And when I say coming back, I mean not like, okay, this is the plan on how to do it, but more like they have a creative kind of a process where they think about from their perspective and see if it actually works as a total package. And they might come back with an iteration on that idea, on that concept, on that brief, where they take it to the next level. But that I felt like this kind of didn't fit and work, so I was thinking that maybe this would be better. And it's brilliant when they do it, and when they come back, that works even better. And usually what it leads to is like three or four interesting positive consequences to the other areas of the game. So it's the game director's job to facilitate for things like that to happen, and then to be the person to detect and kind of utilize to kind of use those opportunities and kind of take them further and communicate to others. And it's a tricky role, because you need to know when to act And of course, you need to also know when to say no. And that's tough. And it's one of the toughest things to be the person that says no. But it's definitely a part of the job, an extremely important part of the job. And ultimately, you're responsible. You're responsible for it to come together. It doesn't matter what are the reasons for your choices. And you might choose to believe certain people, and you choose to take your kind of decision based on whatever you need to kind of do, and you make your choice. Ultimately, it's on you, and so on. So yeah, it's a kind of a complex web of many different elements that I think belongs to that job. Sorry, that was a bit of a rambling answer.
That's a great description. And would you say that that approach is an analog to Remedy's overall culture?
I'm not sure. It's definitely been mine. So I was a game director for the first time at Remedy with Quantum Break. And with Quantum, I joined a bit kind of a late. I was coming back from Sweden. I was working at DICE before that. And I don't think we've had a game director at any project until that moment. In Alan Wake, there wasn't a game director. I was a lead game designer in Alan Wake, and Sam was the creative director. And we never had that role, I think, defined until Quantum Break. Now it's now we are a multi-project organization. We have a number of different things going on, and now it's part of our kind of a basic principle that there is a game director, and he's responsible for the creative vision and execution of the game. And yeah, it's actually a relatively new thing, I would say.
Well, given that Remedy has moved from a single product company to having multiple products happening at the same time, that makes a lot of sense, right? And just speaking of that, how has Remedy evolved over the last few years as it's grown significantly?
Yeah, it's been, I think, necessary in many ways. After Quantum Break, it was clear that we needed to evolve from like a studio that puts everything into one project, and especially considering the type of games that we do, linear story-driven games. And so there's this risk attached to that immediately. Risk to, I mean, as in it's a hit industry, right? And you take a lot of risk with when you do just a single project and so on. So it was a necessary change, and it's of course always tough to kind of change from a studio that has always had this kind of a clear focus on doing one thing at a time, and changing that thinking is hard. We need to rethink how we approach our tech. Before, tech was built specifically for the project, and that was it. Now it needs to be more generic. Now it needs to serve multiple different purposes and so on. So we had to change the way how people work. We had to change how we look at tools. And of course, it's an interesting balancing act where we look at different projects and kind of try to see what is the spectrum of options that exist to us, as what kind of games can we even do or want to do. And those are actually interesting. Like, those are two different answers probably to those questions. And there is this effort, I think, that is happening right now where we are looking into what kind of games do we want to do. And then there's this evolution happening. And it's always going to be a bit behind where we adapt and grow and change the way we do things. We upgrade our tech and so on. With Control, I'm not sure if people are seeing that, but there was a massive, massive change in how we worked, how we approached the game world. And even from a tech perspective, we rebuilt AI, because suddenly when we do a game where you have a very dynamic physical environment, and it's an environment where you have choice, like it's up to you. I want to go through the world. You have this more open-ended world, right? We never built a game like that before. So we had to rethink AI. We had to rethink physics. We had to redo our animation system as well. So a lot of things had to be rebuilt just for that game. A lot of work already kind of started in that way. And personally, if I look at myself as a game director, it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier regarding control and its philosophy. I believe in player agency. I believe in volition. I believe in a world-oriented thinking. And the world is there for you to kind of dive into. And the world can have a lot of stories. It can have gameplay. It can have all kinds of things going on. But it needs to kind of start from that place. And that's how control was built. And us trying to kind of look at what kind of games do we want to do in the future is definitely affected by the thinking. We'll see. We'll see how Remedy is gonna kind of a change from this point on. But I think it's definitely something that is good. It's a positive change, and I think we'll do better games because of it.
That makes a lot of sense. And with all of that internal evolution, is any of it influenced by being a public company?
I'm probably the wrong person to answer that question. I don't feel like it's affected by that. I think we've always been driven by a certain kind of creative ambition to stand apart as an independent studio. To me, it's a strength. It's a value. It's a thing that we should hold on to. That we are creatively independent, and to me, that's what makes us in a way. And for us to be publicly traded, I think I don't think it affects that. I don't think that's how we even think about it. We think that there's value in doing what we do, and we don't worry about that side.
Well, I think your shareholders definitely agree. I mean, you just look at what is, I believe, a really unique situation with the game. The games that you put out are all unique, and they're pushing creative boundaries. And at the same time, you've got another foot in the very staid, sort of conservative fiscal world, but it's working. And that's what I think is so impressive about Remedy's story right now.
Absolutely. And I think it's maybe it is partially that I think there's a certain kind of how would I put it? It's hard to find the absolutely right words for this. But we've been around for, yes, over 20 years. There's this kind of a body of work that we have created, and this DNA exists. And I think everybody here recognizes the immense value of that. And I don't think it's kind of within our fabric of who we are. And I don't think that shareholder aspect would even be able to affect that in a way, at least not quickly. And what I think is actually part of the success is that we don't let that guide us, that we don't focus on the wrong things when we think about what is a compelling experience for our audience. So that's the driving factor, and through focusing on that, I have to believe that through that also comes success.
Absolutely. And so let me just take a step away from the corporate world and just ask a couple personal questions for you. As you look ahead to this next year, where we have a lot of things happening in the industry, what are you most excited about as a player?
Oh, as a player?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of things going on. It's, one of the... I stopped by at Naughty Dog last year and talked with Neil and a bunch of other game directors there and so on. There's something really special about that studio and how they work, what they do, and it's exceptional. And I think Last of Us 2 is gonna blow our minds, I think, in what they do. And what amazing about that, what they do is that there is this kind of uncompromising feel to it. With that comes, of course, I'm sure, a lot of challenges as well, and it's definitely a tough process for them to follow. But I can't wait to see what they've created, and I think it will be in a way defining for the video game industry in a way where we are looking at these extremely polished experiences and that are deep and complex at the same time, and yeah, it's something that I'm personally excited about, and it kind of started from the moment when they showed the first images of the game, and I have to just as a kind of a creative person respect the uncompromising nature that this is the world, this is the game, and they pull no punches, and I think that's wonderful. That's the kind of easy answer, of course. I'm not probably the only one who is really expecting like Last of Us 2. But yeah, that's definitely at the top of the list. And
I'm right there with you on that.
Oh, yeah. And then there's this other side of me is really excited to, you know, like every year there are games that come out that just surprises everybody. Unnamed Goose Game. It's just, or sorry, Untitled Goose Game. Sorry, is the name. I had no idea of that game. Like I had never heard about it, but the moment I saw it, it's like this is brilliant, mm-hmm. fantastic. I love that game so much, and I do love it still. And it's and there's this kind of simple restraint. It's like limbo, like that there is this such clarity in the core idea of what the game is about, and you can see that there is everything that is unnecessary is not there. They made clear choices, and the end result is beautiful, elegant, funny, makes you cry and laugh at the same time, and through such simplicity. And every year it happens that the game like that comes out, and I didn't expect it, and I'm sure that's going to happen again next year. Disco Elysium, one other game, amazing mm-hmm. experience, and I didn't expect that game, and it did happen. So in a way, I'm seeing this I don't know, maybe it's happened before and I haven't just realized it, but these games are like coming out in a big way, clever, independent, bold experiences, and they're done so well, polished and kind of like not triple A quality, but you know what I mean, that it's like done with the quality that makes it click and work, and I feel like there's more of these type of games coming out, something unexpected, something fresh and new, and Death Stranding as well was definitely a unique game, and this is happening more and more, and that's, I guess, I'm kind of looking forward to see more of that, honestly. And I don't even want to see an Untitled Goose Game 2 from House House. I want to see them come up with something entirely different and crazy. I want them to be creative and not ride on the success of that. I want to see what else they can come up with. And I wish to just see more of that than, let's say, sequels to games that we've already seen.
That's fantastic. I agree wholeheartedly with you. And I think our industry agrees. Our industry has been recognizing those games in particular, Disco Elysium, Untitled Goose, and others that have come from nowhere, right? And surprised us all. And I think have inspired us all. So it's really nice to hear you say that.
Yeah. And I think all the kind of acclaim and recognition that they're getting in the industry and so on, different conventions is fantastic. I'm super happy to see that.
Yeah. Well, last question. If people want to ask you additional questions, how do they get in touch with you?
Oh,
are you on Twitter, for example?
Yes. I'm on Twitter @Mikael Kasurinen. And And I think that's pretty much it. I'm on Twitter, definitely. And of course, I mean, if anybody has anything, I can of course be contacted through Remedy, kind of as well directly, and so on. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for spending time today. This has been a really fun chat.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.